And now it came to an end. Exactly when and where? What was the exact time? Now, he says that the general opinion seems to be at the end, that the end came with captivity. Wingarten puts it at the beginning of the New Testament era, but the answers are often lacking or indefinite and unsatisfying, and certainly it would seem in the highest degree unlikely that there should be any historical uncertainty as to the exact point of termination of that kingdom, which began with such a remarkable show of supernatural power and glory at Sinai. I used to hear Brother Sharver say that there was a time during the David's rulership that, brother, it just looked like the millennium was about to come. But I'm going to jump ahead now and give you what I found out as I studied it, why it failed. Number one was the leader they had. And number two were the people that were under. Now, we've already got...
At the end of this chapter?
Well, somewhere way on over there. I jumped ahead. I wanted to give you that to right at the beginning now. But the point comes now that he's going to say that determination was when the Shekinah glory left. Incidentally, did any of you hear Paul Harvey yesterday morning at 7 o'clock? He has just a 5-minute spot now. I've read something about this once or twice before, and I've got it put up somewhere so well that I don't know where I put it. But there is a point at which, at times when everything's just right before the sun rises, that on the horizon is seen the most beautiful light.
Oh, that one burst of green?
Right.
And you told us about that. I read that.
And what was it in?
Reader's Digest. The fellow was up in Maine where he saw it. He claimed
you remember the issue? I've even forgotten the issue. But anyhow, I'll try to check.
Probably about September, October, along there.
But anyway, it's been seen a time or two from the west coast as the sun went down. Now, Paul Harvey yesterday morning told about a preacher in Texas, and he said now he has a good reputation. Wasn't some of these fly-by-nighters or something, you know, like that. So many racketeers in religion today that has seen it from East Texas. And Paul Harvey said that if he could ever know in time when they thought everything was going to be right again, that he was going to go see it himself. Okay, now, I've heard it, and I wish I could get it in a statement to have in black and white, but that there is a light that somebody sees out yonder, astronomers or somebody. It's not a reflected light, it's not a sunlight, a starlight, or anything like that, but they think it is very light source itself. That some manifestation of it has been seen. Now, I just wonder, brethren, of course I know the Shekinah light manifestation was literally a manifestation of the invisible God. And I know Christ will be here on earth in glory during the millennium. Will there be any necessity for this kind of light? And exactly what is that light going to be that's going to light the new earth? It comes from that city. Well, it just makes you wonder. It just excites you or something. We do know that when God said in Genesis 1 and 2, let there be light, there was light, and that was before the red sun, moon, twinklers, shone like that, wasn't it? And I just noted, the other morning, for instance, listening to various broadcasts, and every one of them that I heard that morning from different speakers, different denominational backgrounds, and all of that, how they were just all kind of tuned to the same thing, denoting or what I term broadly apostasy. And yet, on the other hand, you hear some, I noticed this morning, before I left the house, about everything that I noted was going by that time. That's a little too late. But talking about just how many of the end of this age we are, coming from so many different sources, I mean, speakers from. Well, there seems, I say all of that to say this, that there just seems to be some kind of an expectation in our hearts and of something, and you can't put your finger on, and you can't rightly pull any environmental condition out of the air or some happening or anything that would help cause that. But I've noted that myself for several weeks now. I don't know what it is. But in hearing these others, I'm wondering if that's what they're trying to tell. But anyway, we notice that the pillar of the cloud departed not from them by day to lead them in the way, neither the pillar of fire by night to show them light. The glory of Jehovah. And incidentally, this word glory, I ran that down to the best of my ability one time. I don't know how good that was either. Judge it. Kind of like Paul, I can't judge myself. But it means a bright, shining light, a manifestation, a showing forth, something like that. And so that glory often referred to in the Old Testament and named the Shekinah in non-biblical Jewish writings. Now I used to wonder, where did we get the word Shekinah? And this is the first place that I have found the source of it. All right, it's in the Jewish writings, you see. So it was the manifestation of Israel. It was more than a symbol of God's presence. It was a sign and manifestation of His presence. But it also described the form in the which the God of Israel revealed Himself. Now he brought, give a footnote here. Doubtless it is correct to find manifestation in this glory in such Old Testament phenomena in the burning bush, the pillar of cloud, and fire, but there can be no question as to its identification on the Mount of Sinai, where we are told the Lord descended upon it in fire. Exodus 19 and 8. Brethren, I wonder what that was that made Stephen's face so time that the people, the spectators looked at him, he seemed angry. Well, he had said, I see heaven opened and Jesus stands at the right hand of the Father. I know that discussion was in Sunday school here a few weeks ago, and of course I realize that there's a lot of controversy about this experience that some people have in clinical death, you know. And there's been one thing that's always bothered me was that, I read one in the Reader's Digest that the writer almost used the terminology of Paul that what he saw and experienced was just beyond any telling out of human language. But the questions come to my mind, and my wife raised the question, says, why is it that all of them have this beautiful experience on them? This is what of them? Of course, my answer was that was before the actual terminal of determination experience was reached. But now there's another book out that gives both sides of the story, so I want to look at that. But anyhow, that came up in discussion, and other than some that know, that's just a lot of hullabaloo and this, that, and the other, and so on. Well, maybe it is, I don't know. But I raised this question. I said, maybe it was just a one-time experience. I don't know. But I said, Stephen saw something as he was being stoned. And I kind of believe that. In a sense.
So it's possible. It's possible. We know that the intelligence is only operating at maybe 5% at best of its ability in this present body. So it's possible that the spirit, being at that point almost unencumbered by the body any longer, is able to perceive things in their true condition better than what the person that's in normally what we consider conscious form.
Well, isn't this a pretty well, I guess, I use the word founded. I don't know whether it could be true in all of its aspects or not, but isn't there a point of alienation from the body that people have experienced?
And, freedom from the body.
Yeah, that's the point that I'm talking about. There comes a kind of an alienation from the body. Now, my dad had some kind of experience. I wasn't there to tell you about it. But I sat by the bedside of the wife of the old preacher that was a dad to me in the ministry as she was passing. And it's true that she was unconscious. But she was telling some things that she and we could understand. Now, was it true or was it all just fantasy? Well, I don't know. But I do know this, that she mentioned light. She mentioned her husband. Well, here was the descending of the Lord in fire. And what? And when Moses went up by divine command, the inspired record declared that the glory of the Lord abode upon Mount Sinai. And it was here, as we have already noted, the historical kingdom received its constitution and law. And when the tabernacle had been completed, according to all the divine specifications, what happened?
Fire came down from heaven.
All right. The glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. And then later, what happened at the temple when it was built?
That
All right. And so the fire came down from heaven. The glory of the Lord filled the house. Thus the Shekinah glory was the visible evidence of Jehovah's personal presence and rule in the mediatorial kingdom of Israel throughout its history. Now, this writer makes this statement there. Do you know of anything that's any better than that? At this point, I don't. And so, at this point, I'm going to take that this is, as far as I'm able to tell, a credible evidence of the ending of the mediatorial kingdom between that life. Now, I started reading that the other day. It's in Ezekiel 8 through 11, I believe. And I never did time run out on me. I didn't get to finish it at that time then. But I'm going back and reread how this kind of glory got up, went, and it seemed to linger for a while, and then moved on. I believe it went out over Mount of Olives, didn't it?
I think so. He brings it on, moved it over.
Mm-hmm. All right, and so the historical situation at the end. Hast thou seen this, O son of man? Now this is from Ezekiel 8:17. All right, now when did this glory disappear?
In the beginning of the captivity.
Well, yeah, but he says here in this paragraph, the departure of the glory.
Well, the sixth year.
Yeah, sixth year. Is dated by Ezekiel in the sixth year. Now, what six in regard to what? A reference to the time the captivity of King Jehoiakim, 1 and 2. So the prophet had been carried away to Babylon. Now, this is what we've got to try to see to understand that situation there. The prophet had been carried away to Babylon and was sitting in his own house. There were the elders of Israel assembled before him, when he was suddenly caught up by the hand of God and brought in his visions. You get that? Visions back to the city of Jerusalem, 8:1 and 3. And so I wish, if you haven't already, try about tomorrow, and I'm going to try to do the same thing. Let's reread Ezekiel chapters 8 through 11 and get this. And so it seems that the prophet not only saw the vision in the sixth year of the captivity, but also that he saw the actual situation there at that particular time. Furthermore, what he saw of the spiritual and moral condition there fits the historical situation as revealed briefly in other biblical records. And he gives 2 Kings 24, verse 17-20, Jeremiah 52:1-3. Now, following his vision of the events transpiring in Jerusalem, Ezekiel is brought back in his vision to Babylon. Now, have you ever seen something that just didn't make sense to you at the time, and later on something occurred or so on, and you were brought back to that time and actually understood it better than you did at that particular time? I've had situations like that. Some of the most distinct in my time is when I've done all that could be done in a certain place and I want to go somewhere else. The Lord just kind of shut the door. I couldn't leave, couldn't do anything, and what I've had to endure and so on, it wasn't pleasant or anything. I'd rather be doing something else, but I can look back now and see the reasons why. I see the reason why. Okay, now I said to Lewis yesterday, I don't believe in dreams and the visions and so on, as many may try to explain having today, but there are some times that you'll have a dream that's not easily forgotten. It just kind of gets. Have you ever had that experience? Well, when we first moved here, when we got settled, we moved in a house over here on Harvard Street. Were you ever there where I used to live? Mm-hmm. Well, anyway, it was a great big old house. And we liked the room and everything. The house came up for sale, and school could have bought it, but they thought it was too old to be purchased. And so they didn't, but the house has been purchased, and it was a wood-sided house. Now it's been stuccoed and all of that, and there's enough property there. There's been another building built on the back of it, so on. So somebody got a pretty valuable piece of property. Well, I don't know why I was not polite. I dreamed we were living back over there at that house. I could see it's beautiful outside and so on, but I got inside. And wherever there was a petition, termites or something had just gotten in there and just eaten it out, and then the petitions were just all falling. And we had been away on a vacation or something, and had been some people who had come there and stayed around. And I don't know, things were so vivid that it's seldom that I'll ever remember a dream that I've but I did that one. And I'm just relating that. Any meaning? I don't hold any meaning or whatsoever, and I'm not attaching anything. I'm just relating what happened. All right. So, following this vision, transpiring at Jerusalem, Ezekiel is brought back in his visions to Babylon, where he reported to the captives all that the Lord had shown him. Now, we'll get that in 11, verses 24 to 25. Now, should be recalled, and when the king of Babylon had come against Jerusalem, he had with deliberate astuteness taken back to Babylon King Jehoiakim, his family, his treasures, and also all the people of any consequence, leaving in Jerusalem only the poorest and short of the people of the land, and setting up Zedekiah as a vassal king there. And so actually now, Zedekiah was the last king that old Israel had there. All right, now the point we wanted to know is this. Now it might be supposed that such a disaster would have provided an unforgettable lesson to the people left in the land. On the contrary, they acted like men intoxicated with new power. Their accession to property and unwanted position turned their heads. He gives the reference down here. False prophets arose, predicting a speedy restoration of what had been lost in Nebuchadnezzar, contrary to the word of Jeremiah 27, verses 14-22. Furthermore, there was an attempt to secure help against Babylon by diplomatic approaches to surrounding nations, Jeremiah 27:1-7. The consequence was only a deeper plunge into the ways and the idolatries of those nations whose friendships were being cultivated. To view this tragic situation, Ezekiel was brought in vision to Jerusalem, and there the unmistakable warning of Jehovah is found. Son of man, seest thou what they do, even the great abominations that the house of Israel committed here, that I should go far off from my sanctuary? That's in 8:6. The implication is clear. In the face of intolerable situation already existing there, God is still in the sanctuary of Jerusalem, but he may depart. And he did. I wrote that out by that in a month. Now, We notice here what Ezekiel saw through the hole in the wall. I used to have a sermon on that. I borrowed it from somebody. But it's a pretty good subject. And I was thinking about it as I was studying this the other day. I think I'm going to build another sermon. What Ezekiel saw in the hole in the wall. But it's so relevant at this present time. Now, just for instance, in so many different areas. Now, well, let me say it this way first. I finally got the book on brainwashing. Brother Paul Hurtbrook from yesterday. Now, I don't know where we can get to. And I'll bring mine out, try to bring it tomorrow, let you see. But anyhow, I just glanced at it briefly last night. How in the three areas people are being brainwashed, and the third area that this writer takes up is the quasi-religious area. And what they do in this brainwashing, they can do something to you to where you can't use your own power of thinking to choose. And when I saw that, it just literally scared me. Now, I know that this thing down at Ghana, they said, I believe, one close boy about somewhere between 80% and 90% of them were black people. Is that what that said? I believe it was.
I
know.
I didn't hear a bigger question.
Well, somewhere a majority. Okay, we can be safe and say the majority. Okay, but I knew that there's a lot more people, and we couldn't necessarily, and I didn't then believe that that meant anything too much. The other day I was at the doctor's office, had some little pouches under his arms, tubes leading down that had a blood-colored substance in it, and how he would hold out his hand, and there would be some marks in them, and they'd have containers down here to catch the blood. And he could do like that, and squeeze those bags in the blood. And people swallowed that. So he was. Well, I don't know how many different times I've had a statement that I made. One morning I was listening to that in the first half of the night. He said, Lord, there is a little foregleam or enactment of the Antichrist situation. How people fell for it, and so on. And so there you are, and I believe, brethren, that we ought, as much as possible, on the side, is to kind of carry some of our studies a little further into some of these things that are happening today that we might just kind of see. But anyhow, I'll not go into this thing here about, you read that and see what he saw in the hole in the wall, but in other words, well, there were women weeping for Tammuz, 8:14, who was a heathen god corresponding to the Greek Adonis, whose worship was attended by such licentious orgies that the cult was finally suppressed by Constantine the Great. Well, into the inner court, the court of the priests, he saw 25 men with their backs toward the temple of the Lord, facing toward the east while they worship the rising sun. Well, that's what Ezekiel saw through the hole in the wall. Read it for yourself. We'll just pass the rest of that up now. But now, that's a condition, and this is a vision now that Ezekiel saw of the conditions that the presence of the Lord left. Coming down on page 23 to the last statement in the first paragraph, therefore will I also deal in fury. Mine eyes shall not spare, neither will I have pity. And though they cry in mine ears with a loud voice, yet I will not hear them. The end had come. The end of the mediatorial kingdom had come. All right. Now, furthermore, it was the end not only of Israel's political supremacy, but also God have mercy. All right. For just as the historical kingdom had begun at Sinai with a vital union between the political and religious areas of Israel's national life, so now both were involved in the end symbolized by the mitre of the high priest and the crown of the king. Both were mentioned by Ezekiel in his utterance of divine judgment upon the mediatorial nation in the days of Zedekiah. Thus saith the Lord Jehovah, remove the mitre and take off the crown. And look at that last statement. What did it say? Until he come whose right it is. And folks, I'm telling you, I want to see that giant gun so bad that I just wish it could come any day. I just wish it could come any day. And so I just wrote down here, thank God, Jesus is coming. Who's right it is. Well, things that are happening now, right before us, and we don't know what they are. And they'll influence us if we don't. All right. Yesterday, we were noting something about the ending of the mediatorial kingdom. Now, this morning, we'll have to kind of move a little faster. I don't believe I marked exactly where we got to yet. You remember? Did we discuss the vision of the departing glory?
I think so.
All right. Yeah, that was the vision of the departing glory, and that glory was shown for us in what is the Shekinah light. And now don't forget this. We don't find the word Shekinah, and I've looked for that in a concordance, but I learned out of this book when I was studying this that the Shekinah comes out of Jewish writings. That was the word they used concerning this glorious appearance of God, don't you say? All right, now,
here in Topic 124. In this connection, we cannot fail to be impressed with the gracious circumstance of the Lord's withdrawal, not suddenly, but slowly and gradually by stages, with seeming tender reluctance, as if he were actually yearning to remain in the place he had chosen for his dwelling place. But there's no evidence of entreaty or repentance on the part of the nation. The elders bow down to the idols, the women weep for the gods to move, the priests turn their backs on the temple and worship the eastern sun. The God of Israel is forgotten. Although Jehovah had not yet forsaken the nation, the people in their wishful thinking said, Jehovah hath forsaken the land. And so at last they got what they wanted. As God had warned in the days of Hosea, I will go and return to my place till they acknowledge their offense and seek my face.
Okay, and that's going to be, I think, folk, until that remnant, that remnant in the tribulation, the great, and I think that's what Paul's talking about in Romans 9, 10, 11, so on, whosoever shall call upon the name of the Lord shall be saved. That's Jewish ground that he's talking about right there. All right, now where was that you read that statement?
Second paragraph in the top, page 124.
Okay, all right, there you are.
And then right after that, this departure of Jehovah from his temple land marked a change in his theocratic relation to his people, a change that continues even to this day.
Okay, now, get that.
In other words, that refutes what another man said earlier
that the change was over in the New Testament, in other words, Matthew 12, mm-hmm. when they attributed his, he had already left them long before that.
Oh, yeah, right. All right. Now, we want to notice this now. They did not cease to be his covenant people, but in all of these covenant out, I'm not certain, I'll have to check up with you that, but in God's dealing with the nation of Israel, he dealt with them on the basis of four periods of 490 years. And I think it was four, but anyhow, the thing we are watching now was that the crucifixion of Jesus Christ filled out 483 years. Which leaves, and this is where what we call the 70th week of Daniel comes in, is one to be fulfilled. Which means that God did not deal with them successively in every one of these ages, but would break off here for a while and then start again. And it was on these periods of 490 years. And this last period of 490 years is that 70th week of Daniel, which we call the 7-year tribulation of the great, and things like that. Now, that's where that comes in. And when God starts to dealing with the nation of Israel again, we'll be at this 70th week, and so on. So, the point is, and I've heard people talk about that land over there now. Whose is it? Well, they say it belongs to the Jews. Potentially it does. But they cannot come into possession of it aright until they inherit it because it's Christ. And when they get in a proper relationship with Jesus Christ, then they come into that inheritance of that land, you see. All right. Now, the point we want to note is that no longer is here the theocratic kingdom with Israel. Doesn't mean that idea is gone. Now, in the millennium, we will find actually the fulfillment, practically, well, many more elements of the Abrahamic covenant that have not yet been fulfilled, you see. All right, and so now this brings us now to the transfer of political supremacy to Gentile power. There's so much in this, it goes right along with the parables. We had this parable in Matthew 21 where there was a fellow who made a vineyard, hedged it about, planted it, he built a tower in it, and all of this, and he sent his representatives to get his part of the, he let it out to tenants, and he sent his representatives to get his part of what was coming to him, and so on, and they maimed him, they killed him, and this, that, and the other. Well, those were the prophets. And then finally, God said, well, I'll tell you what, this household said, I'll send my son. And they'll treat him right. And when they saw the son, they said, oh, here's the heir. Let's kill him and take the inheritance. That brought up, well, I had a little illumination on that, if you please. What was that? The Jews are today trying to sell Judaism to the world as the Savior. It won't work. They tried to take the very inheritance of being the Savior. Well, they won't do it because they've got to have a Savior, don't you see? Themselves. All right. Now then, when I'm dealing with that parable this morning with them, we got through the interpretation, then I showed them the principle of an application. And here's a little of it I put here. The vineyard, the tenants were the princes and their rulers and so on, that was responsibility. But because they failed to carry out their responsibilities and so on,